This is why we love racing in all its forms.
And it's Lock and Varats, Pride's Easy Feed Victoria Cup.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Payment, what a ride, what a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
With Dan Malecki, Simone Fisher and Matt Stewart, good morning, guys.
Good morning, guys.
This is a big one. This is one of the biggies today.
I'm excited about the show this morning. Very, very excited. I feel I'm in company that I'm not worthy of being in, but...
And Greg Moles is also joining us.
Yes.
Well, what I was referring to is that it is Caulfield Cup Day, guys. And when I think about Caulfield Cups and major races and major sporting events, I think of it through the prism of the voice of the caller, because that's our connection,
yes,
isn't it? So when I think about Caulfield Cups, I invariably think about Greg Moles' Caulfield Cup calls. So... he's going to join us today. Just give us a quick snapshot, Dan or Simone, on who our other guests are this morning, and then we'll roll in the great man himself.
Well, we've got Bendigo Cup tonight, Bendigo Greyhounds, a big meeting there, and Barry Hiscock is going to join us to talk a little bit about the history of the Bendigo Greyhounds and his association with racing that spans over 50 years there.
Ray Benson joins us as well, the octogenarian Ray Benson, and we got the race calling theme high and mighty today, and rightly so on a big day. Victoria Trotters Oaks is a Group 1 race tonight. I remember Ray calling Scotch Notch winning that, I think, in about 1981, and of course he's caught some wonderful animals through all three codes, so we'll catch up with Ray this morning as well.
And he's going to tell us, as Greg Moles joins us, good morning, Greg, because you'll be interested in this. How are you?
Hello, Matt. Hello, Simone. Hello, Danny. I'm very well, thank you, and thrilled to be on your show.
We're going to ask Ray Benson about the time he was dressed up as a barrel girl to replace the ill barrel girl in the Penthouse Club, so that's going to be part of it. Was that ever a range of your entertainment whilst you were a race caller?
I fortunately dodged the barrel girl situation, but I'll be very interested in Ray's yarn about that one.
Yes, indeed. Hey, what feelings do you have when you get to a major race day like this? Obviously, you've been retired from race calling for a few years now. When it comes around to the really, really big ones, does it stir up a few emotions?
Yeah, I'm probably enforces the fact that I'm glad I am retired, because the big meetings are very, very tough work. I love them, but I always loved reflecting on them rather than looking forward to them, because I know what Matt will be going through, and it's you just want to get it right so much that it's the only thing that you think about. And the Caulfield Cup is when it really starts to ramp up. I used to love Caulfield Guineas Day. It was one of my favourite days of the year, because that was the first inkling, The big crowds started to come to the track in that early October period. The grand final was behind you and racing was the full focus, and that's when you really started to... feel the tingle up your spine. And Caulfield Cup Day, it ramps up another level, and it's one of the big three, isn't it? The Cox Plate and the Melbourne Cup, and it's when you just want to be absolutely at the peak of your game.
As soon as one race is over, your focus is on another big race. Greg, when you first started out, it was sort of the transition that you've seen. Melbourne Cup Day, when I was a little kid, and I'm sure you were the same, there was a 7-race program. Now we've got to the stage where it's 10, but you would have gone with that transition. It makes it a marathon day, and I wonder if people really, understand. Well, the Melbourne Cup on one day, but each of the main races on every other day, they're one of 10 races, and you've got to put as much energy into every other race on the card to complete you as a race caller.
Well, that's absolutely right. Most people are only interested in one race and, one furlong of one race, and that's their interest in thoroughbred horse racing for the year. That's the majority of the population. But for we who are involved in it on a day-in, day-out basis, you're dead right. You want to make each big day as perfect as you possibly can. And it's no good calling a fantastic Caulfield Cup if you bugger up the last race, because you'll be kicking yourself, till Cox Plate Day about that one race. So I think that's what it's like about being a race caller. You have to be a perfectionist. Otherwise, you'd slip up too often.
Are you the type of person that would overthink, when the day's finished, that's it? Or do you reflect on what you had done and said and could have done that better and look forward to the next big meeting? Or were you always satisfied with the performance that you had put in on the day?
I don't think I ever walked away 100% satisfied. I think I was probably my own worst critic, and I guess that's a good thing and a bad thing, because it keeps you striving to be better all the time, and it's a bad thing because you can beat yourself up about small things sometimes. You try and be absolutely 100% word perfect, and in race calling, that's just an impossibility. So, you know, you just try for the very best that you can. And I think Matt Hill's going so well at the moment. He hardly makes any mistakes at all, and he's really peaking it in his game right now.
That noise you hear is Simone doing something weird with the windows. What the hell was that, Simone?
Oh, my husband's at the window with some greyhound papers, worry. And he needed an envelope. I was trying to open the drawer very quietly.
He's on his last chance, the Dazzler. There he is again. Hey, Greg, Dan, have you ever coined a phrase or nicknamed a participant or an animal or a human and it's stuck?
I can say yes, but I'll leave it up to you as to where you're going with this.
Well, because we've got a few of Greg's finest Caulfield Cup memories, and this is one of them, I'm sure, Northerly in 2002, because Greg came up with a little nickname that stuck.
Northerly has taken the lead coming around the turn. Freemason is with him. Wider out the second mortgage in Fields of Omar. And further back is Helene Vitality. Northerly down to the 200. Childs pulled the whip. He's the leader from Freemason. Fields of Omar's coming down the outside. And then came Republic Lass. Northerly in front with 100 metres to go. Fields of Omar, Republic Lass are closing. Northerly in front. Fields of Omar tries hard. Northerly. Northerly. Northerly beats Fields of Omar in a photo with a grand.
Naturally, it wasn't in that particular race that you coined the Fighting Tiger, Greg, but you did in another race, and it just stuck, didn't it? It just felt right at the time, and it stuck.
Yeah, it did, and I think it was one of the lead-up races to that Caulfield Cup, or about that period anyway, and I'd sort of just a bit of a throwaway line that he fought like a tiger, and I thought, oh, you know, he wore the yellow and black colours of the Tigers, and I'm a Tigers man, and Fred Kersley told me, he said, I love that Fighting Tiger line, keep using that. Yeah. So I did, and it sort of stuck with him, and it became his moniker, really. So it was a bit before that Caulfield Cup, but he needed to be a Fighting Tiger that day, didn't he? He led virtually all the way with a big weight. It was a fantastic Caulfield Cup, and I think probably my favourite Caulfield Cup.
Which one did you come up with, Dan, that stuck?
Oh, look, it's more, I guess, sayings. As Greg had pointed out, they usually throw away lines. They're not prepared, and they're often the ones that resonate the most. They just they seem appropriate at the time, Greg, don't they? And it's not something like a little line like that that you can plan for, because that would usually go awry. But a saying in a race from a race caller, sometimes the biggest compliment you can get, you'll hear a race caller from anywhere else in Australia, and they'll use a line that you know that you were the first one to use. And some, you know, when you think about it, that is a form of flattery that you don't get it in everyday work, Greg. And I'm sure you would have heard many things that you've said attributable to a trots caller or another gallops caller or another greyhound caller as well.
Yeah, I guess it's something I pinched a few off, Bill, and now that they get passed on down the line, it's just validation of what we do, I suppose. It is a form of flattery, and I'm glad to hear it every now and again.
Now, there's a few that jump out, and you've given me a little list of ones that have maybe a bit of a story attached. So we've got a few little replays here, and you can just take us through. The first one is 1981 and Silver Bounty. Let's have a listen, and you can tell us the story.
Ophir in front with 200 to go. He drew a length and a half clear of Flashing Light. Silver Bounty's the danger, coming home hard. No Fear in front, but Silver Bounty's grabbing him quickly. It's No Fear and Silver Bounty. They're hitting the line together. Silver Bounty, done best. Silver Bounty, a half head to No Fear. Three lengths away, third, Deck the Halls. They're followed.
Tight go, Greg.
Yeah, that was my best Bill Collins impersonation that I could muster back in 1981.
You do it as good as Bill does.
Better than Bill.
Well, that was my very first Caulfield Cup, and I was as nervous as a kitten, as you could imagine. And not many people would probably remember, but it was the old grandstand. The broadcast boxes were in a horrendous position, and they shook and rattled when people walked through underneath you. And it was a terrible place to broadcast races from. We're about 30 or 40 metres off the line. And anyway, it was a bit closer than the half head. Bill was a bit bold there. It was a very, very narrow margin that Silver Bounty won by. It was quite a long, long time for the photo finish to come up. And fortunately, I'd called him winning ahead of No Peer. It was Mitch Didham and Harry White. It was a great finish. And Ken Sturt, who was the judge at the time, gave me the official photo finish, which I've still got in my possession. And so that's a long, long time ago.
Greg, I found on the internet a clip of your ultimate Caulfield Cup, a call that you did, and it was very, very clever, very well done. You're calling the horses, and they had snippets of each of those races, but it was Northerly who got up for you, the Fighting Tiger that you just mentioned. What is it about Northerly and his Caulfield Cup win that made you put him on top?
Well, you know, he sort of beat the handicapper. He carried a big weight, not beat the handicapper, but he carried a big weight, and a lot of horses would dodge that. You know, he's a true weight for age horse, and often they would stick to weight for age races and not take on the handicapper in this modern time. But Northerly did. It was just the style of the horse. You know, he wasn't a particularly attractive horse. He had a big, crabby kind of action, and you wouldn't pick him in a paddock and take him home and say, here's a champion I've just bought. You know, with a dribbling little down his face, he just didn't have it all together. But on the racetrack, he was something different. He had such a great amount of fight in him, and I love that of him. And that's what I said earlier. I thought he was one of the greatest Caulfield Cup winners that I was fortunate enough to call in my 36 years.
Aren't champions funny? Like, if you showed people Rough Habit, Might and Powers, Action, and Northerly's action and appearance, and you said this is the pristine example of excellence of the product of the thoroughbred horse, people are going, really? Jeez.
It really matters what's under the hood, doesn't it?
It does, it does. Hey, 1988 was a big year for you because you received the most difficult baton to receive in broadcasting history, and that was from Bill Collins. Let's have a listen to Impazero in 88.
Into the straight at the 300 or far, led a length and a half, Impazero, then a polo run, Congressman, further back is Bocatar, it's Candide, Impazero's raced up to join or far with 100 to go, here comes Congressman on the outside, Impazero the leader, about a length to or far, Congressman finishing well, Impazero in front, Congressman comes home the best, oh this is close, Impazero or Congressman, they've hit it in a photo, might be Impazero or foul third, they were followed back behind.
Big baton to receive that year, Greg.
Yeah, it sounds like I was nearly going to chicken out in that photo, didn't it? But
I tell you what, you got a few close calls there. Every Caulfield Cup, it seemed like it was a bob of their head at that time.
Yeah, there were a lot of very close finishes, that's for sure.
Lord Reams, the year before, yeah, which was my first one, it was a right bob of the head, and we had the Taxan Arwon one, which was a few years previous. And
then I would have got that one wrong, I reckon. Nearly everybody.
Oh, I think they did, yeah. All the greys at that period, wasn't there? Silver Bounty, Ming Dynasty won a couple,
yeah,
Taxan,
yeah.
Greg, is there a horse that you wished you or would have loved to have called prior to your 36 calls back in the day, like 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago? Is there a horse that you admire that you think, gee, I would have loved to have been in the broadcast box that day?
I'd love to have called Leilani, who was just before I started calling, and it was about that time I started to get interested in the early 1970s, and she was just a darling of the turf, and she won it easily. She just romped in as a hot favourite that day. I would have loved to call Leilani in 74, and probably, you know, in the 60s to call horses like even Stevens and Galilee and Tobin Bronze and Big Falou and those sort of horses that, you know, you just sort of read about and imagine what it would be like to call them. I know when I first took over from Joe Brown, I said, gee, you've been lucky enough, you've had all the champions. You know, what am I going to have in my era? He said, oh, something will come along. You can imagine. I've had Winks and Black Caviar and all these great champions.
Would
Derby Diva.
Would the most replayed race call in history be the Secretariat Belmont, Dan and Greg, do you think? Because And along the back, the race caller says something like, Secretariat's moving along like a magnificent machine. Would you love to have called Secretariat's Belmont, Greg?
Yeah, wouldn't it have been fantastic? I actually just listened to that broadcast the other day because I've been a contributor to a book that's come out about the commentators, and the broadcast was one of them. And, magnificent call. And it would have been a challenge to get the margin right, though, wouldn't it? They don't win by 33 lengths very often.
It was a suburb, wasn't it? It was.
Imagine if you said 35 and everyone had a go at you for you. You're always exaggerating, Greg.
The other call, I reckon, would be the Red Rum and Crisp Grand National. I think the Secretariat and that Grand National, from my perspective, they'd pretty much be on a par.
Yeah, Bill's Cox Plate gets a fair run from 1986.
Without a doubt. What about that year, though? I saw a video, I've watched a video of all the four race callers that day calling the Cox Plate, and all four calls were exemplary, and one of those callers was you too, Greg.
Yeah, the Cox Plate that year, yep.
Waverley Star Bone Crusher.
That day very well. Bruce McAvaney was alongside me, and Frank O'Brien was on course, and Bill Collins, of course. And I remember after the race we came out and we're all just shaking our heads, and McAvaney said to me, Bruce said, how'd you go? And I said, I think okay. And I said, how did you go? He said, I think okay. And we realised when we heard Bill Collins call that was right, we just went okay.
Oh, geez, amazing. Amazing legend, Bill, across every spectrum, not just his race calling. Mm. Hey, Greg, just a couple of more Caulfield Cups to jump out at you, and then I'm sure our listeners are dying to hear what you're up to these days. So any more Caulfield Cups are burnt into your memory?
Oh, well, the obvious ones are Might and Power. That was just an unbelievable victory that year. And to think, you know, he started about 7-1 coming off of the Epsom. That was an amazing win, and that's probably one of the most memorable Paris Lane for Damien Oliver. I remember the in the mounting yard on the Wednesday they did the barrier draw in the Open for the first time, and I went down and after the barrier draw went over to Damien, I shook his hand and I said congratulations for winning the Caulfield Cup, and he shot me a stare that would just spear you, and he said, what are you doing that for? I said, because you're a certainty, and I won't be able to get down in time to say so on Saturday. And he pulled his hand away from me and said, don't you dare do that.
You early crowed him.
I did early crow him, but he was easily able to overcome that. And another one, you know, that sticks in my mind for another reason altogether is in 07 when Master O'Reilly won. That was a year of EI and was probably a reduced, you know, quality field. But the drama that unfolded at the start of that race was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Maldivian and Eskimo Queen, the first two favourites, you know, being pulled out of the barrier and blood dripping down his neck as he returned to Scott. It was just an eerie, unbelievable pre-race scene that stuck with me.
What are you up to these days, Greg?
Still follow the races very, very closely. Follow them every day and still do the form and love it from afar. I'd love to get back on the track. That's the thing that most of us are feeling that way at the moment, I suppose. But enjoying retirement. I'm into the boating life a little bit, and that takes up a bit of my time. But just enjoying sitting back and watching.
Well, I think there's a beer garden with our name written all over it in the next few weeks. So,
oh, I'll say, yeah. Wouldn't need much convincing.
Or out on the boat floating around Port Phillip Bay sounds all right with the skipper.
And Simone, you know how Greg sounds, very measured and polite. He's always the last to leave.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, somebody's going to pay the bill.
Hey, mate, thanks so much for joining us. I know it's a big special day for everyone, but a special day for you, and your voice resonates through so many memories of Caulfield Cup, so congratulations on that, and enjoy the Williamstown Yacht Club.
Yeah, good on you, Matt. I shall do that when it opens up again, and hope everyone has a great Caulfield Cup day. Nice talking to you, Simone. And you too, Danny.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
It's a huge night of racing at Bendigo tonight, and there's one person who has been around the club for a very, very long time, and that is 50 plus years, and that's Barry Hiscock. And Barry joins us this morning on Cracking the Codes. And Barry, you've got quite a lot of knowledge and information that you can talk to us about this morning about Bendigo, but you must be looking forward to the meeting tonight also.
Yes, I am, Simone. I've been a member of the club for over 50 years and spent a lot of my life at Eagle Hawk in the old days and at Lord's Raceway. So I've got a fair bit of knowledge of the club.
You sure have. Now, Bendigo started in 1920 when they were coursing in the middle of the Epsom Racecourse, moved to Eagle Hawk, like you mentioned, and in 1978 at Lord's Raceway in its current location where the trotting track is adjacent to the Greyhound track. It's a great complex there. And can you just tell us about that whole transition? Because you would have been around back in 1978 seeing the formation of the new club, a new track.
It certainly was. What happened, we raced at Eagle Hawk on the football ground. And, of course, everything was ageing. They had wooden kennels and we needed an upgrade on it. But the government wouldn't put any money into council grounds. And the Bendigo City Council, Dick Turner was the mayor at the time, and he wanted us to go where the swept centre is now, the basketball stadium. The council, they were going to do all the earthworks, do everything for us, but the government wouldn't put any money into it. And that's how we ended up going to Lord's Raceway. But Lord's Bendigo Trotting Club, they owned their own track. They owned Lord's Raceway. It had been gifted to them by A.A. Lord. He was a building shops and that all over Melbourne. And they had to get, the day we bought the land, they had to give their track back to the government. And it become Crown land. It's all Crown land.
Well, Barry, it's a lovely setup there. The last couple of Saturday nights with the Bendigo Harness and the Victoria Cup, the Dogs have been on as well. So the same precinct. And, you know, one stage I went down between the races and it was a great shame that there were no people there because the way it's interconnected, it offers so much entertainment. And it's been a pretty busy precinct, Bendigo, particularly the Greyhound track there over the last month or so.
It certainly has. We were very lucky over the years. We had a chap called Brian Jennings. He was the secretary of the Greyhound Club for 35 years, and he was also the secretary of the Trotting Club. And he was the whole building set up, he was the man behind it. It's a lot's owed to him with what the setup is. But we've been lucky in the last probably 10 or 11 years. We've had a good manager in Troy Harley, a Greyhound man. He knew what we wanted, and what we've got there now is excellent. We've got straight track, galloping runs, let-out yards, everything that you'd want for training greyhounds we've got. And that's probably down to Troy.
Barry, 50 years is a long time to be associated with any club, so your passion certainly shines through. But what is it that really keeps drawing you back to the club year after year?
It's only been a hobby for me. I've always had a job all the time. I wasn't just in greyhounds for greyhounds, but I got my first greyhound when I was 15. What happened? I got rheumatic fever and I wasn't allowed to play any contact sport. So I started off, I used to ride my bike about 3 or 4 miles to an old bloke called Jack Somerville, help him walk his dogs. And then I got one of my own and I went from there. And I've had them ever since. There's only one period for about 3 months and I've never had a dog.
And you also dabbled in a little bit of harness racing back in the day too, didn't you, Barry? You used to help out some of the locals around Bendigo.
Through going to the Dogs at Eagle Hawk, I met a bloke called Frank Power, and he was a local businessman. He had butcher shops and a small goods factory, but he dabbled in for the greyhounds. Roy Rogers used to train for him. He had a couple of gallopers, real good gallopers, and he had the trotters, which he used to do himself. Anyway, once I got to know him, he talked me into going and working horses with him. Well, one thing led to another, and the next thing I've got a license to drive, and had some funny moments with him, actually. I've been nicknamed Lady Godiva the Second through my association with Frank and the Trotters.
Yeah, you'll have to tell us that story because I tried to explain that story many months ago on Cracking the Codes, and I'm not a good storyteller, and B, I probably forgot half of it, but you'll have to tell us that story about you stark naked on a horse heading down the highway at Bendigo.
On the top of this, where the big APCO service station is, on the next hill, there was a big dam, the trotting boat. Jack Wilson owned it, and he built it to swim his horses in. Anyway, we had a horse called Yalabon Moon, and he hurt his knee. So the old guy, he was getting a bit of age, old Frank, and he said to me, "Well, we'll have to swim him." "Yeah, righto." So up we go. There's a tin boat there. So I'm rowing the boat. He gets in there. We've got the horse on the bank. No way of getting him in. As soon as we row out of bed, he keep pulling us. Said, "You'll have to swim him. Go in, ride him." Righto. So like a dealer, take me clothes off, and all I've got is me undies on. We get him in. He takes this almighty leap in. It's a really deep dam. When he got in, you can't sit on him. So I've jumped off, got my hands around his neck, and I'm guiding him around. He's going terrific. And all of a sudden, he makes his mind up he's going to get out, and he's heading for the bank. And I thought, I've got no shoes on. If he stands on me foot, it'll break me feet. So I jumped back on him, only got a head collar, no bit. And, of course, we've left the gate open, the paddock, and I'm on him. I don't know whether he ever tried to ride a horse. Bareback's bad enough, but when they're wet, he's slipping all over the place. So he's headed for the road, and I'm stark naked on top of him. Anyway, down the main road, and he went all the way back to the stables. Oh, talk about embarrassing. People were looking at me, but I had no way of controlling him. Only, as you know, you're a horse lady. He had a head collar, no bit in his mouth, and just couldn't stop him at all, away he went. But I had some good times in the trots, I really did. But I started work. I've got a new job, and I started working at the railways and shift work and that, and I just couldn't do it. So, and that's how I was, always had dogs. All the time I was doing the trotters, I had dogs. But I met some good people in the trots. One person that Dad would be interested in, I became friends with a bloke called Rod Osborne.
Yes.
Tasmania. He came over with a horse called a Nougat. They were going to win the Inter-Dominion. And Rod went on to be a steward with the harness racing in Melbourne, and then he was the head steward in Queensland.
Yeah. And he only passed away, I think it was last year.
5 months ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And Paulie and I were great friends with him and Helen, and we used to go down there for tea and that with him, and he was right on the ball. He had his own form guide. He used to cut the pieces out of the paper and the results and that. They had like scrapbook. He was a very good driver, Rod. And when he came over, he linked up with Kenny Wills. He had his horses at Kenny Wills's. Yeah. And that's... But anyway, when I got out of the trust, I lost contact with him until just before I retired. I worked in the railways in the booking office, and Rod and Helen come in. Their son was living in Bendigo, and they caught the train up. And they came in there, and I caught up with him after about probably 40 years I hadn't seen him for, you know.
Barry, another connection or big connection that you have with greyhound racing is, of course, your son, Corey, who is the curator at the Meadows and arguably the best curator in the world, many would say. His expertise and advice is sought worldwide at their tracks just to see how we do things here in Australia. But you must be very proud. He started off as a 14-year-old lure driver at the Bendigo Club too,
yeah,
didn't he?
And then before that, I used to go and trial at Manning's Trial Track, Norm, and Norm's actually a cousin of my mum's. And Corey's only about 8 or 9, and Norm used to let him drive the lure, trial it, and he'd bring it back to the next trial, and that's stand him on a box, and away he went. But I was the president of Bendigo in the 80s, and everywhere I went, Corey was 2 steps behind me. And so he sort of knew everything that was going on, and then he met Ronnie Eisen. Well, Ronnie Eisen was the greatest thing that happened to Corey. Ronnie taught him everything he knows, and he's gone on. Just recently he went to Darwin, they had a look at their track up there, and he put a report in what was wrong with their track. And when Kennington, not the one now, but when they did Kennington before, they were having trouble with the sand on their track, and they got Corey to go over and have a look at it, and he had a look at all the sand heaps and told them what to put on. But he's dedicated. It's all he ever, he was educated, pretty well educated. All he ever wanted to do was do the greyhound track. But is that just an odd aside to that, we used to race at Olympic Park, and Corey's only a little boy. Oh, he was 9 or 10, I suppose. And Pauline would say, "Have you seen Corey?" I'd look over at the driving tower, and he'd be there talking to Tommy McPherson. And if he wasn't there, he was up in the broadcast box with Ronnie Hawkswell. And it's funny, today, Corey drives the lure at the Meadows, and Ronnie's calling the races next door to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly gone full circle. And I had the absolute privilege of inducting Ron Eisen into the Hall of Fame a number of years ago, Barry, and his family were absolutely lovely, and he was revolutionary, wasn't he, in Victoria, and with the lure system and the safety of tracks a long time ago, and his legacy lives on today.
Lovely fella. And Corey, when he was old enough to get a car, Ronnie had by this time had moved to Murchison, and he designed the roll-on boxes, you know, the first ones for Geelong, on and off. Corey drives the trials to Bendigo to lunchtime, and Saturday he'd come home in the car and away he'd go. We wouldn't see him till about 10 o'clock the next night. He'd be up with Ron and Irene at Murchison for the weekend, and he'd do that every weekend he'd go up there. But as I said, Ronnie taught him everything he knows.
Now, Barry, in a 50-year association with the Bendigo Club, obviously you've seen at least 50 Bendigo Cups. Is there one that springs to mind that really stands out that, you know, a very vivid memory for you?
Yeah, I thought Fernando Bale, the 91, was a real good effort. But another one, Lansley Bale, the 91, he was a good run too. But it's funny, like, of all the years, there's only about 8 or 9 locals in that 50-year period been able to win the Bendigo Cup. The locals don't seem to be able to win it. But there's always been good dogs in Bendigo. Somebody's always got a city class dog or a good class city dog, and they don't seem to be able to win the Bendigo Cup, unfortunately.
Oh, well, hopefully one day. Look, Barry, as we say goodbye and thank you for your time this morning on Cracking the Codes, I know you listen to it every Saturday morning, which we love, so it's great having you on as a guest this morning. But we'll say goodbye and we'll take a listen to that Fernando Bale replay. And thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Simone.
Racing, and Fernando Bale away brilliantly, straight to the lead, the favourite settling down of a shared equity. They were followed by Billows picking behind them then. Over on the outside is Ron Ray Spirit, followed by Mapungarama. Out at the tail end, Powderer and Fearless John up to the turn though. And Fernando Bale, the leader, shooting for 15 and end. Turns for home clear, over shared equity down the outside. Fernando Bale in front, and Greyhound Racing's excitement machine. Fernando Bale won the cup from shared equity and breathing fire, followed further back by Mapungarama. Pungarama, and then came Ron Ray Spirit, followed by Powder Roy Fearless John, and the time is 23:43.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
And our next guest has been an icon for many years. He's an octogenarian now, Ray Benson. He's been a fabulous race caller and worked with the very best in the business. He's got some wonderful stories to tell about the Penthouse Club, and he was a trainer and he was a driver of harness racing as well, Ray Benson. And it's great to have him on Cracking the Codes this morning.
Hello, great man.
Hi, Ray.
Hello, Simone. Matty.
We're going to have a chin wag about your life.
This will be interesting.
Ray, I was telling Matt and Simone about your venture into race calling and where it began, and it was from a neck of the woods where Bill Collins pretty much come from as well. Gippsland's produced some pretty amazing talent in the race calling ranks. Tell us about your start in calling.
Started down at on the 7th of November 1957. I'll never forget it. It was won by a horse called Prophecies, ridden by Alan McLean. And it was trained by a fellow called Rex Roylance. And he was the brother of Rollo Roylance, the sporting writer.
Yep.
And I'll never forget that day as long as I live. I got a hold of the race book about an hour or so before the first. Turned over to page 1, handicap maiden plate, 21 entries. So I thought, this is nice. If they all run, I'll make a nice fool of myself. But anyway, they divided the race. I think I had 10 or 11 in the first race and about 8 or 10 in the second. So we got through. It was okay. It was good.
Ray, you mentioned Rex Roylance, and Rollo was one of my bosses when I was starting out, and he was a lovely guy. So many great stories of an era that I never experienced and none of us would have. And got to know Jack Elliott. They were big figures back then, weren't they? Like the race callers and the racing journos. Racing was massive, and Jack Elliott would have been the biggest, and Rollo, they would have been the biggest media figures in town almost, wouldn't they?
Yeah, Jack Elliott, he was fantastic. He spoke his mind. Rollo, I think his nickname was the Cheerful Chestnut, is that right?
Correct.
I think, Cheerful Chestnut. And Jack Elliott, he was the number one rider. Derek had paid for T.J. Smith. And those fellas, they were huge in their day. Fantastic.
Ray, you've worked with some of the most iconic names in broadcasting. To mention a few, Bert Bryant, John Russell, and particularly Bill Collins, who you built up a wonderful association and friendship with.
When I was 3 years old, I was number 3 caller, Bert Bryant and John Russell. And because I was number 3, they called me the third man from the Harry Lime theme. And
which was a novel and movie, Graham Greene novel, but exactly. A famous movie as well.
So you were this mysterious third man, Ray.
Yes, exactly. So I was at 3UZ for about 13 years, and then I moved across to 3D Beach, Channel 7 with Bill. I was at Bill with Bill for 15 years. I've always maintained that Bill Collins is the best race caller, and not only that, the best bloke on the earth. Best race caller I've ever heard. I don't think he'll ever be equaled. A couple of blokes that come close to him, Greg Miles, naturally. Matty Hill, present-day caller, does a sensational job. And likewise, pardon me, Adam Crittenden. But they were the great names in those days.
The day there was when those 2-year-old step out the Maribyrnong trial, and it was one year the night before Bill rang you up, and tell us about what he asked you to do before all the Maribyrnong trial races.
He rang me on the Friday night. He said, "Oh Ray," he said, "I'm pretty crook." He said, "I've got the flu." He said, "I'm aching all over, sneezing my head off." He said, "I think you've got to go to Flemington tomorrow." I said, "Oh, thanks, mate." So I had four divisions of the Maribyrnong trial stakes. There were two for the Colts and Goldings and two for the fillies. I think I had 25 in one, 26 in another, 22 in another, and about 24 or 5 in the other. But I had a walk-up start, basically, because I was going to the trials, and I would see a lot of the T-rolls doing their, early work. So I got to know quite a few of the colours, but we got through, but it was an absolute memory test.
I'll ask you about your little stint as a barrel girl in the Penthouse Club, and it sounds like a club that I'd love to go to, and it's long gone, and Mary Hardy and all these great names of that era. But why was... We all know Bill Collins was a great caller, and everyone always talks... Keith Hillier used to... When Keith Hillier walks into Caulfield, you might know this, Ray, he always pays tribute to the Bill Collins statue, and I think he puts a flower there or something, doesn't he?
Yes, I do the same thing. I've never ever gone to Caulfield since the statue was erected. And not gone over and had a chat to Bill. But that barrel girl situation, I was at the Showgrounds Trot one Saturday night, and apparently the barrel girl didn't turn up or was sick or something. And I got a call after the Showgrounds, "Ray, would you come in and we want you to do the barrel girl?" I said, "You're kidding."
Well, you had the legs for it.
Well, thank you. anyway, I jumped in the car, went in, Terry Clifton took over and called the rest of the meeting. And they dressed me up as a barrel girl with a dress, a wig, hat, high heel shoes, and a couple of oranges where they should be placed. So I came.
Did you enjoy it, Ray, the cross-dressing? Yeah.
No, not really, mate, right. To be honest with you. No, I wasn't into that capable. I did it on that night. And I got home, and the wife at the time, she said, "Who was that idiot on the barrel girl?" She said, "She was hopeless." And to my knowledge, he doesn't know who it was to this day.
Oh, my God. Hey, why was Bill such a great bloke? Everyone, and the fact that you do and Keith pay tribute, he must have been, and Dan might chip in here as well, but what was it about Bill that made him such a lovely guy?
Well, I can, from my own point of view, when I had my speech problem and a throat problem, which I've got to this stage, you can probably pick up, He said, "Ray," he said, "you've got to beat this." He said, "I don't want to lose you." He said, "You've got to beat this problem." So he took me to a psychologist in Collins Street, trying to rectify the problem. He drove out to my home, picked me up, drove me back into the city, and then drove me back home again. And it didn't work out, but I tried very hard, but just couldn't beat it. So anyway, that's the way it was.
Not everyone would do that.
No, exactly. Well, the only people that knew was myself, Greg, Bill Collins, and his wife Robin, three people, and the psychologist bloke. So what they do, they take you into a room. They gave me what they call an intravenous amitel injection, and it steadies you down. And, if I have two or three champagnes, I can say anything, twos and tens and Fs and thuts and all that sort of thing. But if I get uptight, my speech used to go to blazes, and... anyway, it just cost me my job, and I just couldn't beat the problem. I even did an intensive course in speech therapy at the Royal Hospital, which lasted 7 days. And they said, if you do everything they tell you, at the end of the 7th day, you'll be fluent. Well, I failed. I just couldn't get through.
So how did you step up to the stage behind the microphone calling races so successfully for so long when you had this panic issue with your voice?
It crept in over a few years, and when sometimes when I was calling a race, doesn't matter what names. I used to have trouble what they call hard contact sounds, the T's and the S's and that sort of thing. Like, I had a horse called Terrific Tom or something. Not during the race call, but after the race, if it won the race, I would have trouble with the T, Tom. Or if the tote dividends came up, $2.10, $65, all that sort of thing. But when the race was run, because your brain is intent on, A, memorising colours and learning colours and calling colours, it didn't worry me. But as soon as they pulled up and I had to give the numbers to, you can bet your sweet life, the numbers came up, 2, 10, 6, whatever. And
Speaking of T's, Taj Rossi was a famous name, and here's a Sandown Guineas Wing defeating Image Eel, called by you in 1973.
Well, just over 400 left to go, and Noma first into the straight from Image Eel. Taj Rossi is now starting to wind up quickly on the outside around the home turn, down to the 300-metre mark, and Image Eel's gone to the lead, beaten off Noma. Taj Rossi is now joining in on the outside, and they've drawn well clear. Nandevilas running on. Image Eel and Taj Rossi settling down to fight it out. There's nothing between them. Image Eel, the rails, Taj Rossi the outside. Taj Rossi got about a hit on Image Eel, which is battling back well. Here's a great go. Taj Rossi starting to draw away, and Taj Rossi has won it by, I'd say, about a half nick on the line to Image Eel.
Well, Ray, there was absolutely no worries about your speech in that. A terrific call back in 1973. That would bring back some memories. And you've also called all three codes, and one of those, of course, is the Greyhounds. Can you just tell us about your days at Sandown, where you used to have to walk across the roof and there was like a little tin shed on top of the roof of the broadcast, for the broadcast box?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The old tin shed on top of the roof at Sandown. I didn't mind the... I love the Greyhound industry, and... you know, the Greyhounds, they went quite that quickly. It was hard to keep up with them. I maintain you had to be a specialist in Greyhound calling. John Munday was a caller many years ago, and he was fantastic so far as a Greyhound caller is concerned. I thought he was the best.
Is there one code that's easiest to call?
I used to love the trots, because I drove at the trots. I had a couple of drives. But I love the trots itself, and particularly at the showgrounds. You know, some of the people that used to get there, you'd get... I remember the night that Bold David won the Inter-Dominion, you could not move at the showgrounds. There were that many people there. They were absolutely packed. Fantastic night.
Right. And you called the last race at the showgrounds, and you called the first race at Moonee Valley trots.
That's a funny story. Bill and I were standing back in the box at the showgrounds for the last race, ever to be run. Horses came out of the track. We knew most of the colours. And I'm standing back waiting for Bill to go to the seat and call the race. And he said, "Come on, Ray, jump in. You're right." I said, "Bill, this is history." And he said, "So what?" He said, you're doing it. Away you go. So I called the last race at the showgrounds, along with John Russell for 3 years in and Bruce Giggs on the course. And then the next Saturday night, I think it was, the first race ever run at Moonee Valley, same thing. Bill said, "Come on, Ray, jump in, you're doing it." So I'd call the first race at Moonee Valley, along with Bruce Giggs again.
Yeah, right. Now, can you recreate the showgrounds for us? We've had guests on before who have spoken about how the crowd was almost around the whole circle and so on, but what was it like? How did people get there? What sort of public transport? Did you drive? Did you catch a train? What did it look and feel like at the showgrounds?
Well, you naturally could drive there by car, but the tram, you could get a tram down Union Road, Ascot Vale, walk up Langs Road up the back, and there was also a train station at the showgrounds, but I stand corrected here. I don't think the train was operating on the Saturday nights when the trots were run. I could be wrong. So, you know, you could get to it pretty easily.
All types of people you would rock up from all ends of society?
Oh, yes. You know, people like yourself, Matty, you know, superstars and all that sort of thing.
And then down to the Dan Malecki types as well. Yeah.
Exactly. That's bottom of the barrel. Exactly.
Did you ever see Gregory Peck at the trots at the showgrounds?
No, I didn't see Gregory Peck.
The late Jim Houlihan told me a story about Gregory Peck, and I'm going to have to tell it because it's quite funny, right? And I do a good Jim Houlihan impersonation, so everyone wins out of this, Ray.
Yep.
So I was down with Jim and Molly down at Rosebud many years ago, and he was telling me stories about when he was a big trots punter. And before he was into, building Calder Park and all that, he was the biggest and most respected trots tipster and punter at the showgrounds. Yep. He'd go to the showgrounds. Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner, Dan, good sort, were out here making On the Beach in about 1959. Gregory Peck loved the trots, and he started going to the showgrounds during the filming of the movie. And he asked around and said, who's the best tipster? And they said, oh, it'd be that young, tall, strong-looking bloke over there called Jim Houlihan. So they became lifelong friends, Jim Houlihan and Gregory Peck. I'm not sure if Ava Gardner was on the fringe, but anyway. So I asked Jim if he kept in contact with Gregory Peck. And Jim was a parochial Australian who never left Australia, right? So I said, Jim, what about the enduring friendship? And he said, well, it's an interesting story, actually. He rang me from a place in the United States called Hollywood. And he asked me if I would like to visit. And then Jim knocked him back three or four times. I said, oh, did the friendship keep going? He goes, no, in the end, he became a bit of a pest because he kept asking me to visit him. And this is Gregory Peck. So there you go.
What you're saying about Jim Houlihan is right. He was a huge punter. Loved the bet. Loved setting one up.
He did. And there was another one where he went over to Adelaide with his punting mate, and they sat in the grandstand, and he sent his mate down to have a bet, and the bloke came back and said, Jim, we're off here because the more I put on, the more they're turning the price out. And Jim said, it would take an act of God for this horse to be beaten. And then I said, what happened then, Jim? He said, a hand came out of the darkness in the infield and grabbed it by the bridle and let go after 400 metres. Yeah. And he said, I'm not even sure if a body was attached to it. What do you miss most about that? What was the heyday for you when you look back? Was it the showgrounds with Bill, or was it calling in front of those massive crowds where you can't even hear yourself think? The noise was so loud. What's the greatest memory for you?
The English Derby. I called the English Derby back to 3DB in 1976, won by Ompere and Lester Piggott. That was one of my highlights. Also, I called the ring in at Castellan, you know, Royal School in Leicester.
What are your memories of that?
Well, when they came around the turn, Apex Star, which was the best sprinter in Western District at that time, it led and had Royal School outside it, and I said in the call, Apex Star, half length to Royal School. And you know what it was like? I couldn't help myself. I said, this is feeding him going half pace. When he lets this go, this will win it easily. And as you know, it went on to win. And then the inquiry started, and I was calling the trots at Shepparton about 3 or 4 weeks later as the inquiry was going through. And I was doing the meeting for 3DB Channel 7, actually. And I walked into the betting ring to check the betting before the race. And I bumped into this fellow, Rick Renzella. He said, Ray Benson, he said, you called that race at Castleton the other day. I said, that's right. He said, that horse of mine was never going to win, was it? I said, Rick, I'm telling you now, it was never going to get beaten. He said, where can I get a copy of your race call? I said, you can't. I said, if they play my call of the race, I said, it makes it worse for you. He said, I'm in the car business. He said, if you come to the inquiry and change your call to suit me, he said, I'll buy your wife a brand new car. I said, Rick, not it. This is true.
So then a few weeks later, your wife had a brand new car?
No. Actually, the whole story is in Andrew Rule's book, Chance.
Right.
Yes. I've got that book. I haven't got to that story yet, but I have got the book, and I'll get to it. Ray, what are the best greyhounds that you've called?
I'd have to say Tim Lee and Liz Reen.
Yeah.
Liz Reen was trained by a mate of mine, Peter McGuinness, and I'd say Tim Lee and Liz Reen were the best two that I called.
I don't think you get too many arguments there from many in the race in the greyhound world. I didn't see them race, but I'm sure that there's plenty that echo your sentiments.
Hey, Ray, can you promise us something, right? Because we're coming out of this nightmare of COVID, and we're already starting to think about beer gardens and Johnny Russell and Dan Malecki and Matty Hill and Greg Miles, who we've got on this show today.
I think I know where this is heading.
And keep the next day clear.
Yes.
Yes. Are we up for that?
Yep.
Simone will be there.
Yep.
Yes.
I get an invite, do I? Oh, very good. The token female.
We'll make it. Oh, no, you're there. You'll be the hostess with the mostest. There's no doubt about that. You'll be the number one seed. Ray, we thank you very much for your time this morning. As we say goodbye, I want to bring up one memory. Surely this horse must be one of the greatest harness horses you've ever called and most people have ever seen. We'll see if we can jog your memory with this. Mary's Idol.
Off the back, inside the 400-metre mark, and Mary's Idol well cleared. He's 35 metres in front of Derby Royale. He's got about 15 gears, this champion, Mary's Idol, and he's only in gear four. On the turn, 150 metres to go, Mary's Idol is well clear. The clock showing 1:41. He's about 25 or 30 metres in front of Derby Royale. Elsa Davies battling on, followed by Touch Merchant and Hilton Elias. Halfway down the straight, Mary's Idol well clear, 52. Derby Royale is battling on. Here's the winner going to the line, Mary's Idol, 57, 58, and he's run 59.3. Mary's Idol first, followed by 30 metres. Close to second and third, Elsa Davies, Touch Merchant and Derby Royale.
And Hilton Adios, to hear the crowd in the background go off when the clock ticked over to that time, Ray, and you were part of, in history on many occasions, but was he the best you saw, Mary's Idol?
Yes, yeah, but he and Scotch Notch, I'd say. But he probably would have been a better horse, a better driver.
Yeah, oh, God, I missed Mary's Idol, but I wish I hadn't. Hey, who... Of all the race callers, when you go and have a social drink, which is the one who's still got the race caller's voice even when they're just talking normally? Darren McCauley sounds the same. Which is the one who you could tell straight away as a race caller just by hearing his voice?
Jack Starring, when he was
yes.
when he was fit and well. He's on the sick list at the moment, but, you know...
Johnny Tapp would be another one,
yeah,
I suppose.
John Tapp, another one. Bill had a beautiful voice. Bill Collins.
Yeah, he
started Greg. And I love Adam Crittenden. He's crystal clear and straight to the point. Matty Hill does a sensational job. We are blessed with the best callers. Best callers.
Well, and you were one of them, even though with your self-doubt and so on that you've explained with the voices and so on, but you were absolutely pure as silk, Raymond.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Appreciate it.
And we're... Proud to have you on Cracking the Codes this morning. We wish you good health, Ray, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up with you at the races in the very near future.
Good on you, mate. Thank you very much for the invite.
Well, guys, we've come to the end of another terrific show, but just before we do finish up, some very sad news coming out of the greyhound world this week with the sudden passing of Paul Wheeler, who obviously has the dynasty of the Bale dogs, and shocking news all around. I'm sure we'll hear more about him in the following weeks and what legacy he has left, but no one knows greyhound racing without having heard of a Bale dog going around. On that note, guys, I'm looking forward to doing it all again next week.
Thanks, guys.